Another year, another Westival.
G'day, folks. Welcome to my country.
It's a camping holiday, but with folk music. What's not to love?
Welcome to the theremin revolution.
Do you jam?
Do I jam?
How was the view?
I've never blown up an amplifier before.
Well, that's because you've never played with me.
Jesse's in trouble, and it isn't for Stan.
Lovely, lovely.
Cheers!
It's a great little festival.
It's too safe. They book dinosaur pub rock bands.
I am a 26-year-old folk chick, lucky enough to get paid for it.
I'm not going to pretend that pub rock is my scene.
It is not pub rock, it's folk rock.
Folk rock is pub rock.
The punters love it.
Punters loved Hitler.
Wow.
Choose a love story for the spine of Three Summers?
Because I think I'm naturally romantic. I like writing love stories. I think that, you know, love is at the heart. Love, the desire for it, the yearning for it, the celebration of it, and the pain it can cause is at the heart of the human experience. And so I pretty much always, mostly, I will put a love story into my work because, as I say, I love a love story. I think.
How do you find the different thing in a love story, given that they're pretty popular?
Well, I mean, you don't want to find too much that's different, because what you're actually doing is exploring common experience. You know, everybody is. I've done routines about love since I first started. I mean, I was a stand-up comedian. Everyone thought I was this sort of sweary lefty, and in many ways I was. But I did an early routine about how Mother Nature has put the emotions right in the gut. It's not the heart that aches, it's the stomach. When you fall in love, you feel sick with it. You feel that. I did a routine. I said, but it wouldn't look so good on the Valentine's cards, you know, 8 feet of small intestine with an arrow through it. But, you know, that's you know, I've always been interested in the common experience of a strong, I think I'm perhaps, you know, one of the strongest emotions of all are caused by love, because, you know, the pain of bereavement is all about love. Yeah. You know, the fear for your children or your love, it's all about love. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of ways to look at it, but that you should never try and reinvent it, because it's sufficiently multifaceted not to need that. I mean, I try and find something interesting. I remember 25 years ago when I wrote this other Eden. I had a gay love affair at the centre of it, which was, you know, fairly original. That, you know, wasn't so common for major popular novels and things. It was lovely to write, you know, from a different loving perspective, whatever, to basically do exactly what I'd have done with a man and a woman, but do it with two men. In this case, I've had a lot of fun with the idea that opposites attract, and of course, with musicians, that's the most, you know, hell hath no fury like two musicians who disagree with each other over modern jazz or whatever. Yeah. So the idea of, you know, two people who are clearly meant for each other but are massively in their own way, or at least in this case, he's in his own way because he's such a pedant about his musical beliefs that it stops him basically impressing the girl he's already fallen in love with. You know, he keeps pissing her off because he can't stop getting in his own way. I don't know. I just love a love story. Do you think that's a good question?
I actually think love's pretty hard, actually,
yeah.
Because I think that we have sort of generic versions that we get used to in rom-coms, but and when I saw this, I thought, oh, nice. I just liked the idea of, he's actually quite a pure character. He's a bit dense and not seeing what she's about, but I thought it was interesting how pure he was in the end.
Yeah, he won't back down. He has his beliefs, and even when he's, you know, talking to this beautiful girl who he's smitten with, he can't stop himself being honest, you know. And she's very honest too. She's just a much more pleasant person in a way. I was just saying to Peter, I mean, one of the breakthroughs in a way in the casting was I originally had him as a Pom, and Robert auditioned as a Pom and did very well and got the role, and he did a very good English accent, but when I was talking to Rob, I just realised it's a hugely charming vibe. And of course, the Southern Irish accent is very charming. It's very lilting. It's very pleasant to listen to. You know, I'm not the first person to notice what a lovely accent it is. And I thought that would be great to mitigate against the pedantry in the character. And I think it was a very good move because it just sort of helped him not be completely irritating. Because I think maybe if he'd been a sort of estuary pom, which is how he was playing it, like me, really. He was basing it on me. You know, with this slightly southerny sort of estuary, sort of mockney sort of thing. Not mockney, you know, whatever. And I think that could have been to the point where people might have thought, we don't want Rebecca, we don't want Keeley to go with him because he's an arsehole, you know what I mean? And I think the accent helped. It was just a small thing, yeah.
I think it did help, actually. Yeah. And now, the other thing that I was thinking about was that you've obviously taken a... you've had a good go at Indigenous material here.
Mm-hmm.
Who did you talk to in terms of getting some, you know, who did you consult with?
Well, a great deal of due diligence, obviously, because you don't think yourself into other people's shoes, you know, with lightly, in my opinion. And, of course, the further away from my own experience, the more carefully I have to tread. I don't believe that I'm disbarred from inhabiting anybody's imagination. I don't believe the new idea that all cultural appropriation is wrong and that I should only write about balding, middle-aged white men born in London, half Jewish, you know. I don't believe that because, you know, all art is an act of the imagination, so it's ridiculous to suggest we can only be journalists on our own experience. But having said that, you do have to have, you know, you have to have due diligence when you are moving into other areas. If I, for instance, I mean, as a novelist, I've written a character, a female, who was the, you know, the victim of sexual violence. Now, clearly, unfortunately, I've never been a victim of sexual violence, and for women, much more common for them, etc. So I'm certainly moving into big territory, and I've got to be very fucking careful, and I've got to do some proper research and think about this properly, as I always would, of course. I mean, that's what I do, that's what I like about being a writer. So, with the Aboriginal thing, clearly, it was very important. I knew I wanted to have a Noongar story, because I don't think you can do a collection of Australian stories without having an Aboriginal story as a part of it, because that's the original story, and everyone's attitude to the great open wound that is the nightmare Indigenous experience in this country informs us all at all times, and it's never gone away. So I really wanted to have a story. Of course I wanted it to be fun and light. I didn't want it to be yet another, you know, liberal bleeding heart or whatever. So there was due diligence in that both Screen Australia and Screen West have Aboriginal Affairs officers who looked at the script and I talked to them and they had some great thoughts. But the real pleasure and the real passion came when I met Kudar, who's you know, a senior figure out of Pinjarra at the Fairbridge Village, and he introduced me to the dance guys, TK, and all the mob doing the dancing, and then we started yarning and talking, and Kudar read the script and he loved it and he gave me real hope because he said, I feel you've got us. And I think the thing that really sold him was that the movie opens with a welcome to country, which he really loved because I don't think anyone's done that before, you know. It was just a no-brainer for me because I've got this wonderful radio opening, so great, let's do it. What a lovely way to start the film, you know, pay respects to the very land we're taking a beautiful drone aerial shot of as we speak, you know what I mean? Mm. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of talk, which resulted in true friendships. I mean, I saw Kudar only last night, Mandra and a bunch of the mob, and You know, we're friends. It's been a really big learning curve for me, big journey to become, you know, embraced doing some ceremonies and dancing with the guys and, you know, down at Pinjarra. So, yeah, I just thought about it a lot and talked a lot.
Set it in a Fairbridge-like environment, and I believe you've been to Fairbridge a lot.
Oh, yeah, about four or five times, yeah.
And what was there that sort of captured your...
Well, just the obvious to me, I say obvious, I think it was about 3 years before it occurred to me that this was a great meeting of stories. And the reason I suddenly thought of it was because I was sat in the bar and I was looking at all these people and thinking, this looks exactly the same as last year and the year before. Honestly, it's talk about deja vu, it's like nothing's happened, nothing's changed. But everything must have changed because everybody here has had a year's worth of experience since they last mingled with each other. you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, the obvious one was, you know, this year's cute busking kids will be next year's aggressive, sweary, goth teenagers. You know, that's an obvious one.
Yeah.
But, you know, the subtler changes that happen to adults and things. And maybe it would be great storytelling to see how the encounters they have at this fictitious festival affect their lives and change their attitudes. So, it seemed obvious the moment I thought of it, not least because as a filmmaker I suddenly saw the whole economy of scale in that. I thought, great, this is a permanent location. If we can film here at Fairbridge, we've already got the huts, we've got the chapel. Obviously we'll have to put a few tents back up, but not many. I mean, obviously we shot very tight, and above all we can shoot at the real festival and get our crowd scenes, and that's $1 million worth of budget for all those big crowd scenes, kebab alley, you know, like 10 kebab vans, and we come back later with one kebab van and we put Kiwi in front of it, and Christian Van, what's it in, you know, the beautiful guy from the Bondi Hipsters, you know, and so that's, you know, that's shooting tight.
Yeah.
And then we cut to a wide and you see all the other vans, but that's actually the real festival. So I thought, this is amazing. I've got the whole thing. Not only have I got this wonderful world of stories, but the world's actually here physically that we can come and film at. No location shifts. The death of movies is location shifts. It eats your budget, it eats your time. Having a shift. And I just thought, how fantastic, we're going to be on one location. That's how we shot it in 5 weeks.
And because you were filming in Western Australia, did you, because I heard you say, well, this is my home.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn new about your home because you actually were here filming?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to come up with a sort of Chinese cookie on that, you know. I think at my age, one sentence lessons are kind of a long way back. You know, when you're young, you learn not to touch a hot kettle, you learn not to tread and dog shit. But by the time you're 58, things are subtler. And the changes that happened to me are subtler. I've been around WA on and off for 30 years. All I can say is looking at not only the script of Three Summers, but what I produced with the movie, I agree with my dear friend Jennifer Saunders, who, when I showed her the film in London, just say, oh, look what I'm up to, look, show it on a computer. At the end of it, she said, gosh, Ben, you really have become an Aussie, haven't you? And I was very touched and surprised because I knew she enjoyed it, thought it was funny and all of that. But she spotted that, and I thought, well, I hadn't really put that into words myself. But actually, this is a distinctly Australian film, and I don't think I could have done it 10 years ago or 20 years ago or maybe even 5 years ago. You know, but now my kids have all been through the Aussie state school system. I've been a part of various political platforms in Freo, and, you know, been a part of the community. You know, and then I make Three Summers. I can't tell you what it is I've learned that's meant I've been able to write this. But if I write Australian characters that Deborah Mailman and Kelton Pell and Magda Zabanski and Michael Caton and John Waters are prepared to inhabit, then they must feel they're genuine Australian characters. And so whatever lessons I've learned, you'll find in the movie, I guess.
Okay. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. That's great.
I just wanted to go inside and get a drink of water so I don't dehydrate when I'm there.
Do not make me take you down.
Perhaps we might go and see a bit of music later.
Really? That's not like us.
Look at that dance troupe, skipping around naked, covered in paint. Bloody ridiculous.
We're just not exactly an obvious fit.
The best harmonies never are.
Why do I have to be on the end of the line, Henry?
Somebody's got to be at the end of the line, Bob. It's the nature of a line that there's somebody on the end of it.
This is Queenie wishing you all a folking good night. It's a joke. Please don't write in.